Thanks for tuning in to part one of this conversation with Dr. Jennifer Frontera and Dr. Brian Edlow on Frontlines with Frontera. In the first half, they explored the fundamentals of consciousness and the emerging concept of covert consciousness, along with what it means for prognosis and decision-making in the ICU. In part two, the discussion shifts towards what comes next, how these insights can inform treatment strategies from neurostimulants and rehabilitation to brain-computer interfaces and other emerging technologies, as well as where the field may be headed. Let's get back to the conversation.
What are the options for treatment interventions once you diagnose covert consciousness? Does this have implications for rehabilitation strategies, medication strategies, stimulants? You mentioned computer brain interface, deep brain stimulation. What are the options that are available now, and what are we looking at in the future potentially?
So the implications can be profound for this diagnosis. And I'll start with the communication. If we make this diagnosis in the ICU and we communicate that to families, multiple studies, if you look at work from neuroethicists Michael Young, Joe Finns, Arian Lewis, and others, multiple studies have shown that the emergence of consciousness in the ICU, whether it's overt behavioral signs or covert signs with advanced neurotechnologies, that is a major determinant of family decisions to continue or withdraw life-sustaining therapy. So just making the diagnosis in and of itself can have life or death implications for what treatment trajectory that patient's on. Once a decision is made to continue life-sustaining therapy, so let's start with pharmacologic therapies. Are we more likely to choose neurostimulants for that patient early on? You know, a lot of this is style and judgment. There are really no guidelines here, but some clinicians might be more aggressive with starting pharmacologic stimulants earlier on in a patient's disease course. We might pay closer attention to subtle signs of consciousness on the behavioral exam. And actually, this is a really important point, which is there are many reports of individuals being found to be covertly conscious with advanced neurotechnologies, and then the team will look for more subtle behaviors and pick them up and realize that maybe there was actually gaze tracking that we never picked up, or a subtle movement with a finger or a limb. You know, it gives us a clue that we should be looking more carefully. So sometimes it changes the way we examine the patient. With respect to rehabilitation, this is a really interesting debate. Many clinical and ethical dimensions to this. One could argue, and I support this position, that the presence of covert consciousness should lead to greater access to rehabilitative care. On the other hand, it's important to acknowledge that those rehabilitation facilities require participation in physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. And if somebody cannot physically express themselves, by definition, they can't really participate. So, you know, what are the therapies that will help somebody regain overt signs of consciousness after a covert consciousness diagnosis? I don't think we as a field have answered that question yet. I hope that we will soon, and I hope that people with this diagnosis get more access to rehabilitative care, but I don't believe there's been a huge kind of change in our approach as a field.
I suppose we could think of them somewhat as locked-in patients, or similar to locked-in patients who really can't physically necessarily manifest their thought processes, but do have capability of communicating with very subtle motor things like moving their eyes or whatever. Maybe it's sort of like a continuum with locked in towards almost locked in, or having some partial capabilities.
Well said. And I'll come back to the brain-computer interface part in a moment, but I think you highlighted a really important point here about the spectrum of what is often referred to as cognitive motor dissociation, another term that's used to describe covert consciousness. So the idea being that the individual has a higher level of cognition than they have of motoric output or motoric expression. And to your point, locked-in syndrome would be a complete dissociation. So somebody with a spinal cord injury or ALS, for example, completely normal cognition, but paralyzed, perhaps except for eye blinks or eye movements. Patients with covert consciousness, the patient population that we've been talking about thus far, traumatic brain injury, cardiac arrest, stroke, hemorrhage, etc. When there is a dissociation, their cognition, at least we believe, is still not normal. there is some brain image, there's some brain injury there that we can see on imaging, and we can see signs of it on electrophysiologic tests like EEG. So understanding how much that person is capable of, how much of a dissociation is there? Are they close to locked in, or are they a much lower level of consciousness? It's really challenging based on current testing to make that distinction. One consideration here, which was made in that New England Journal paper I mentioned, with led by Elena Bodine and Nico Schiff, they made the point in the discussion that in order to sustain attention and perform one of these tests, it suggests that there might actually be a pretty high level of complex reasoning, working memory, attention, because the commands are given sequentially. With fMRI, it's often 6 or 8 times in a row in blocks of about 15 or 20 seconds. With EEG, it might be 15 or 20 times. So you've got to do this over and over again. And if healthy controls are not doing it, you know, 25% of the time, what does that say about the level of awareness of a patient who can do it? It might be far higher than what we would expect. But the bottom line is, I don't think we can really tell at this point how close a patient is who is covertly conscious to the locked-in state that you describe.
And so in terms of computer-brain interface, which is used on locked-in patients or people with severe neuromuscular disorders like ALS, has that been tried in covert consciousness type of patients? And if so, what is the success rate?
So let's distinguish non-invasive brain-computer interfaces from invasive, because there's a fundamental distinction there. So non-invasive, scalp-based EEG, for example, where you're asking that patient to try to link a certain mental behavior to a yes-no response. So for example, somebody's getting a tapping signal on their wrist, and you ask them to count every time they feel that tapping signal if the answer to a question is yes, or you ask them to count a tapping signal on a different part of their body that's being given with a different cadence if the answer to a question is no. And you're trying to decipher these purposeful brain responses based on electrophysiologic rhythms or waves measured at the level of the scalp. We and others have tried to do that. Largely, these efforts have been unsuccessful in this patient population. And I think it has to do with the signal-to-noise ratio. It's just a far lower signal-to-noise ratio when you're measuring these signals at the scalp as compared to intracortical measurements. And, you know, fluctuations in vigilance. These patients, even if they are high level from time to time, you might not catch them when they're at their best. And it just takes a tremendous amount of effort, a sustained effort, to eventually create a non-invasive brain-computer interface. There's a really compelling intervention that I would point your listeners to. Nico Schiff's group published this in Science Translational Medicine a couple of years ago, where they were able to establish communication with an individual using a non-invasive device. But again, this is quite rare. So if we then think about invasive devices, and you know, here at Mass General, Lee Hochberg, who's been leading the BrainGate study with Sid Cash and others, they have shown truly mind-blowing progress. I mean, stuff that I would have considered science fiction that they're turning into a scientific reality with these microelectrodes implanted in the cortical surface that are decoding neuronal activity and translating that activity into movements with a robotic arm or typing, controlling the cursor on an iPad or a laptop, even recreating somebody's voice based on recordings that were taken before they became paralyzed, and then training a computer to speak on their behalf based on their thoughts about what they want to say. I mean, truly groundbreaking advances that are giving functionality back to people who are paralyzed.
Now, is this a spinal cord injury population, or what kind of population is he primarily working with?
So that is a locked-in syndrome population. So patients who have normal cognition but impaired motoric function from spinal cord injury, brainstem stroke, and ALS being the main kind of population.
Then we have to be that much more clever with these TBI or cardiac arrest folks, where it's not going to be the same region you can access because they may have injury, primary injury there. And right, so maybe they have a language area injury, so they're never going to really be able to formulate speech per se in the standard ways you would do with an ALS patient, for example, with CBI. And then you'd have to create a different, more creative way for them to communicate. Yeah, so it's that much more challenging, it seems, than other patient populations.
Absolutely. And you highlighted this kind of key multidimensional problem where first there's the anatomy. If we as a field are going to do this, and I want to acknowledge that Dr. Hochberg and Schiff are leading a team to start bringing these brain-computer interface technologies to patients with covert consciousness. But as we move in this direction, there are anatomic issues that you highlighted. You know, where exactly should these microelectrodes be placed? Is it going to be different for each individual? How rigorous and robust do our structural and functional brain maps have to be before we feel confident that we know the right placement of these electrodes? And then from an ethical standpoint, what is the burden of proof? How much evidence do we need as clinicians that that individual is covertly conscious before we say it is the right thing to do, it is clinically and ethically appropriate to perform a surgery to place this invasive brain-computer interface? The potential upside is massive, as big as it gets, restoring self-expression, communication, interactions with loved ones. But any surgery's got risks, bleeding, infection, et cetera. And how convinced do we need to be that that person is covertly conscious? How many different tests need to be positive before we are sure that the potential benefits outweigh the risks? That is a critically important question that we're all trying to work through right now.
I'm also wondering about, you know, a subgroup of folks where arousal might be the primary injury. So maybe you have a bilateral thalamic hemorrhage or stroke or something like that. Are there ways besides stimulants that you had addressed? Is there any data on deep brain stimulation or anything else like that to improve arousal that might help these people also?
Yes. So the seminal paper here, Nature 2007, co-led by Schiff and Giacino, showed proof of principle, N of one, but a pretty dramatic result in a single individual, that deep brain stimulation electrodes placed in the central thalamus could improve an individual's behavioral interactions. This was somebody who was not in the ICU recovering spontaneously, but rather somebody who was in the chronic state, minimally conscious, and with blinded behavioral examiners, they showed that there was a significant difference in how interactive this person was when the DBS electrodes were turned on compared to when they were turned off. So a pretty dramatic and inspiring result. That this was one of the studies that kind of played a formative role in my career development. When I read that, I was like, I want to do this. I want to map these patients' brains and figure out who could benefit from these treatments. But if you look all these years later, there haven't been that many more cases. Now, that group has some groundbreaking work just published in Nature Medicine recently on patients with traumatic brain injury who are conscious and they still have cognitive or physical disabilities, where they showed that thalamic DBS can lead to meaningful improvements. But for the disorders of consciousness population, there has not been much follow-up work. There are some groups that are doing this, both in the US and internationally. There's a group at Brigham, Dr. Sam Snyder, John Ralston, and colleagues recently got funding to launch a new study looking at this. But, you know, it's an invasive procedure. And it, you know, I think we as a field are still trying to figure out what are the risk benefit analyses for each individual patient, who's an ideal candidate. When you're talking about the chronic setting, there's a lot of atrophy that's set in. So again, targeting becomes an issue. How do you know exactly where in the thalamus you should be targeting when there's been substantial atrophy? So tremendous promise from that Nature 2007 paper, but still a lot of unanswered questions.
What about transcortical magnetic stim or TD direct current stim? Has anybody tried that?
There's some elegant work out of Liège, Belgium. Olivia Gassiers, Aurore Thibault, and colleagues who have looked at that. And yes, I mean, there were some encouraging results from that group with TDCS, TMS, but the gains are often limited. So, you know, everything is being tried, but unfortunately, as you know well, this is a patient population that is incredibly complicated. There's often multifocal injury where, you know, coming back to the targeting issue, that can be very challenging. And, you know, it's important that we are hopeful and optimistic and look for every possible way to identify patients who could benefit from these types of therapies. But we also need to acknowledge that there's some patients who have such severe diffuse injury that they just may not be candidates for these types of treatments. And we haven't figured out yet how to identify the potential responders from those who are unlikely to respond.
Right. Patient selection is a challenge because the population is just so heterogeneous in terms of where their injuries are. And I know there's an interest even in you know, vagal nerve stimulation in the rehab community, mostly for motor response. But, you know, the concept that you're sort of flooding the brain with neurotransmitters so that when you do apply a stimulus for rehab, that you're more likely to have making, you know, connections, fire to rewire or whatever. So that's that. It's very interesting. And I'm wondering, just to sort of wrap things up, if we have any information on how patients themselves feel about the condition that they're in or the therapies that they're undergoing. And, you know, maybe we can draw some parallels from the locked-in syndrome patients who are really able to fully communicate how they feel about their goals of care or their trajectories of recovery or their life satisfaction.
It's a profoundly important question, and I wish that we had some insight into the patient experience. You mentioned the locked-in syndrome population, where if you look at it 1 year, that population, my understanding is that the reports of people being happy to be alive, satisfied with their quality of life, is far greater than one might imagine or than we might predict. In the covert consciousness population, we just don't have that experience of being able to interact and really ascertain what their experiences are like. So we can really only speculate, which is frustrating because we need to better understand, you know, what is the right way to provide care to somebody who's covertly conscious? How do we begin to think, for example, about palliation, about pain control, about anxiety? That's a question actually that many families have asked me after we detect evidence of covert consciousness. Should my loved one be receiving an anti-anxiety medication or an antidepressant, just based on the assumption that they might be anxious or depressed? An incredibly challenging question to answer. And, you know, I don't have a strong opinion either way. I think this is still something we're trying to figure out. But, you know, I hope over the next few years we'll be able to answer your question, Jen. But right now, unfortunately, I don't think we have enough information.
It is interesting, though, that certain populations, cardiac arrest or locked in folks that may have said before their injury, absolutely, I don't want to be in this condition. Once they are injured, they reframe their point of view or their reference and are potentially more accepting of a level of disability than they were before they got into that situation. And I think that might be more common than we understand as clinicians.
Absolutely. Study after study has shown that people tend to be more accepting of disability once it happens than they would have necessarily predicted if they had been interviewed before the injury occurred. So agree with you 100%. And again, it speaks to this prognostic humility, the theme that we touched on earlier, which is, you know, really trying to understand what an individual would want, respecting their dignity, respecting their autonomy. We often, the guiding principle is what that individual has said or written before the brain injury.
Right.
But those advanced directives don't always reflect what happens to people later on. So it adds yet another layer of complexity and nuance to these discussions.
So just to wrap up, I'd like to ask, what are you most excited about coming down the pike in the future in terms of covert consciousness research?
Appreciate the opportunity to reflect on this and think about where we as a field are going. So first, I'll touch on diagnosis and prognosis. We focused on task-based fMRI and EEG. Those techniques have changed our field. They've changed the way that many of us think about consciousness, your original question. One technique that I didn't talk about as much, but I am particularly hopeful about, is transcranial magnetic stimulation EEG, TMS EEG. The idea being that you give a magnetic pulse to the brain, non-invasively, and then you measure with EEG the electrical ripples that emerge. The analogy we like to use is it's like throwing a pebble into a lake where the magnetic pulse is the pebble, and then the electrical ripples are the waves in the lake. This technique, developed by Marcello Massimini and colleagues at University of Milan, appears to have far greater performance characteristics, sensitivity and specificity, for detecting consciousness than does task-based fMRI or EEG. So it's a technique that Dr. Massimini's group and others have used in the chronic setting. We're now working with Melanie Boley in a multi-site trial to do this in the ICU. And we are particularly excited about this technique because the data speak for themselves. It just has a far lower false negative rate than the other tests we talked about earlier. So from a prognostic and diagnostic standpoint, that's where I'm most excited and hopeful right now for these patients and their families and the future of our field. From a therapeutic standpoint, I think two things. One, our brain mapping is advancing rapidly, structural and functional, and we have to use these personalized brain maps to figure out how to select patients for treatment. There are many clinical trials that have been done, as you mentioned earlier, that have not shown evidence for efficacy at the group level, but many of those treatments may work. We just didn't select the right patients for the trial. So we've got to get better with respect to individualized brain mapping and selection for clinical trials. And then in thinking about the treatments of the future, you mentioned DBS. There's a lot of reason to be hopeful for that. Certainly non-invasive treatments should be considered first because of the lower risk. But as our understanding of brain circuit electrophysiology improves, we should be able to manipulate and stimulate these circuits more reliably in the future. And so I have to think that DBS has a future. And then finally, brain-computer interfaces, that project that I mentioned being led by Drs. Hochberg and Schiff. You know, when you think about the possibility of giving a patient with covert consciousness the opportunity to express themselves, it's a game changer. I mean, it fundamentally changes somebody's quality of life and their ability to interact with loved ones. So I am very hopeful that we will figure out how to identify the patients most likely to benefit and give these patients a voice.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that EEG TMS might help us localize areas for intervention also, and then you could do targeted TMS once you figure out where it's most efficacious to apply it based on the EEG response. I don't know if that's true. I thought you might be going in that direction when you initially brought it up.
It's a great idea. And absolutely. there's a lot of interest in figuring
out. I'm sure someone already thought of that.
But it's a great, we're trying to map with structural and functional connectivity which parts of the cortex are most connected to the rest of the brain so that we know where to stimulate first just for diagnostic and prognostic reasons. But once you do that, to your point, you've now found a potential hotspot for treatment as well. So for your listeners, we should start designing trials with Dr. Frontera's idea there. It's a great idea.
Wow. Well, thank you, Brian. It was so great talking to you. So interesting. I feel like I learned a lot. And thanks to all our listeners. And until next time.
Thank you, Jen.